CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be. Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, dear listeners. This is Kate Riga. I'm here to make a quick pitch that you consider becoming a TPM Prime member. TPM has used the member model for over a decade now, and our loyal members are the only reason we've been able to weather the turbulence of the media landscape and avoid the fate that has befallen so many other independent outlets. For $70, you get no paywall, fewer ads, access to the Hive member forum, a members-only newsletter, and more. For $140 a year, you get all of that, plus no ads at all. Without our members, there is no podcast, not to mention that I'm out of a job. Thank you so much for listening and supporting us. We couldn't do it without you.
This is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast with Kate Riga. We are going to start off today talking about the Trump trial. Yesterday and today, yesterday we had opening statements and a few other miscellaneous things. And today we're to the first witness. And obviously when you get to, I noticed this morning. So I want to say one thing. I think we are recording. We had to do a little rescheduling this week because of something else we're going to be talking about, which is a bunch of stuff coming up from the Supreme Court this week. Kate is obviously going to be covering that. But just today, I noticed that our traffic to the site is really high, and it is almost all for Josh Kovensky's live blog about the Trump trial. And before we got started, we were having a little TPME conversation with Kate and Jackie, our producer, about how great a job Josh is doing. And without naming any names, it's kind of an example of we were kind of happy because it's a good example of one of the people covering this trial who's really deep into the details, into the substance. And not only this trial, Josh covers, in addition to various other beats, covers most of the Trump trials legal stuff beat for us. Kate is also involved in that, but Josh, that's kind of his main thing. And so tomorrow, as it's mostly going to be during this trial, Wednesday is going to be the one day where they're off. Sometimes they'll do like another, you know, not in front of the jury hearing or something like that. So in any case, tomorrow we may not have the live blog, but I want to make sure you know about it, because obviously this trial is going to be going on for a while, and Josh is not only very knowledgeable, but I think all of us at TPM he's just good at the live blogging, right, through the testimony. And this is the, you know, we've done all of this trial stuff about Trump, things in front of the Supreme Court. So lots of things, lots of courtroom things that we have covered, that we've live blogged over the last year. Obviously, we live blog other topics. But now for the first time, we're getting into an actual trial. Opening statements. Today, David Pecker, the guy who used to run the National Enquirer, is up there. So that has a different dynamic, right? That's different from legal arguments. So in any case, I just want to make sure you know about it, because he's doing a great job. And this is something where the legwork that our team puts in really shows. Because, you know, what we have always tried to do at TPM is pick a relatively small number of ongoing issues that we are going to assign members of our team to, and they're going to go deep and really understand the details. And what that means is that when that issue comes to the fore, you're going to have someone at TPM who's able to cover it, not just as a sort of a kinetic in the moment story, which we definitely always want to be on top of and capture, but do it with a lot of in-depth knowledge so that they're able to do it at a level that a lot of the rest of the press really isn't able to do. And like, you know, we've seen something similar from Kate when we have, you know, the different times when the abortion issue comes up with state referenda or the whole ongoing litigation with mifepristone, you know, the main abortion drug, having people who really understand the issue in depth makes for a breaking news coverage that is an order of magnitude more informative, better, sometimes more entertaining, because you're learning a lot than you'll see from a lot of other places. So I just want to kind of put that on your list to remember to catch his live blog, which, you know, we're still, I think we are still playing it by ear, how we're going to cover this trial. I know that going into it, we were sort of like, you know, we're not going to, we don't know how the trial is going to proceed, kind of what the, you know, what the dynamics are going to be. So we're not going to say in advance, we're going to, you know, cover every single day like it's big breaking news, because maybe it'll be kind of pedestrian, right? Parts of it will be. I think as it's happened, it's been, there's been a lot to cover. So at least for the moment, we've continued to, you know, dedicate our main kind of Trump legal accountability beat reporter to it each day. And maybe the dynamics of this will continue on that basis. You know, we don't know exactly, but at least for the foreseeable future, we're going to be doing these live blogs. And I just want to recommend it to you and just give kudos to one of the, you know, we have, we are in one of these blessed moments at TPM where each of our reporters is really kind of a star and doing amazing work, and that certainly applies to Josh. So to start off, we are going to talk to another one of our stars, Kate Riga, about this trial. It's the first thing we're going to talk about today. So what have we seen? So what is your sense so far of, you know, we're kind of first witness today, but what's your feel? What's the vibe?
So when we talked about this last, you know, we just had, we were just in jury selection, right? And we talked about, I think, the most important beats there, which is how do you select a jury, you know, when you've got the omnipresent threat that Trump will kind of goad his supporters into, like, tracking them down. And the whole question of how can you find people who don't have strong feelings about Donald Trump, you know, particularly in Manhattan. And then this week,
And if they don't, maybe there's something wrong with them.
Right, exactly.
Who are these strange people who have no strong feelings about Donald Trump?
And then this week, we're like shifting more into the meat of things. You know, we have the opening statements where we can kind of get a sense of the shape of the arguments each team is going to make. And it kind of boils down to, you know, the prosecution has to show that the hush money was in service of, you know, another misdeed to kind of elevate this to a felony. So the biggest thing for them is to show that this isn't just kind of a tawdry, sordid, hasty patch-up job. So Trump would not be revealed to be, you know, a philanderer because of this
Shocking.
Specific episode.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
But to say this was actually, this was election interference. This was not to kind of cover his ass in front of his wife, but to keep critical information from the voters right before they were going to make a decision on whether to elect him. And the kind of inflection point that emerged from that opening statement is that this was all connected to the nucleus of the Access Hollywood tape, which was the rare episode that broke through the kind of Trump noise and the sense we all had from the beginning that Trump is kind of a scummy guy. Like, even the people who like him, that's part of the appeal. But Access Hollywood was, I mean, it was shocking. You know, it's the only time Trump had to issue a real apology. You know, it had people just completely writing postmortems for his campaign. And so the prosecution is really hammering that point as like, that's the motive. And that is why Trump really, really, really had to make sure that this follow-up story didn't come out and solidify, you know, his dive with women voters and the sense that he is just this kind of terrible guy. So that was their argument. And you also got a sense from that opening statement of their biggest liability, which is Michael Cohen, because a lot of this rests on his testimony and what he says happens. And obviously, you know, he spent years shilling for Trump. He went to jail and then is now trying to kind of pivot into a media personality by virtue of totally flipping on Trump. So he's not a very reliable witness. And that's something they are going to struggle with because they need to show the connection between those things. And he's kind of the biggest joint in that connection. So that's kind of where the prosecution's coming from. The defense is just doing this kind of very cynical, trying to make the juror tap into this defeatism that Trump always tries to spread in the electorate, which is, this isn't out of the pale. This is politics. It's grimy. It's dirty. It's sleazy. And this is just part of that. You know, this wasn't election interference. This is the very bedrock of democracy, is using kind of unethical means to try to sway an election. So that's the opening themes from each side. And then we have Pecker to the stand, where, you know, the defense is trying to use him to be like, so this is something that happens all the time, right? Describe the inner machinations of your catch and kill, of, you know, how you kind of pay for stories, and, you know, trying to expand this into the greater Trump worldview, which is everyone's a bad actor. Everyone is kind of looking out for themselves and just motivated by self-interest. There's no such thing as kind of ethical, upstanding journalism. It's just a money-making business. And this is a, you know, a banner example of it. So that's kind of where we are after this first, what, day and a half of like meat of the trial.
Is there, I mean, you know, I've tried to get my head around the Cohen credibility issue, because it's an issue, to put it mildly, right? I mean, he said when he was part of Team Trump, he said all sorts of absurd things, and now he is not on Team Trump. And so, you know, what possible reason, other than kind of liking the fact that he's no longer on Team Trump, does one have to think he's telling the truth? And yet there's this other part of it that he has the reinforcing or kind of iron lock of logic behind him, which is, okay, he comes into court and says, Donald Trump told me you gotta deal with this Stormy issue, you know, make it go away. Okay. And we know that Michael Cohen is not a terribly credible guy, but what else possibly could have happened?
Yeah.
I mean, what else possibly could have happened? I just say it a third time. What else possibly could have happened? Your fixer fixes it. And do we think Michael Cohen had sex with Storm? I mean, what else possibly could have happened? I guess I'm curious the defense never has to offer an alternative theory of the case, just as a matter of basic trial doctrine, how trials work. It doesn't have to prove anything. It just has to undermine the case that the prosecution is making. But in practice, it is greatly helpful for you to offer some alternative theory, because you know, you don't have to, but you do have to get a jury to acquit you. And so the only conceivable argument that I could see as an alternative theory of the case is, yeah, he was my fixer. He fixed things. His job was to fix things. I didn't know everything he was doing. This was him kind of going rogue. And he had, you know, he signed the deal years and years ago, or arranged the deal years and years ago. So this was him kind of, you know, cleaning up a mess that he had made before I was. So, okay, that is not very credible at all, but it's at least in the realm of, you know, it's not gravity making some things go up rather than go down, right? So that part of it, I'm just curious how the moving parts work on that, because that's pretty key. Again, what else was he doing? I mean, and then I guess there's, you know, you get to that issue of, oh, I was just trying to, you know, preserve Melania's feelings. I'm actually kind of curious there, like, well, they certainly wouldn't want to open up the argument of how much does Melania know about Trump having sex with tons of women when they were married? Is that, you know, do you go there? And I guess another question is, you're putting a lot of, you're putting a lot of Trump's intentions into the mix. It's always a little dicey to do that if you're not willing to let him go on the stand. And like, I'm almost certain, I mean, he's saying he's going to testify. Good luck with that. There's no way that's going to happen.
It's funny because it brings up echoes of John Edwards a little bit, who he kind of got out of his cover up infidelity problems by pleading the, I was trying to keep this from my wife, not to defraud the American people kind of thing. And it's interesting because obviously Trump, I mean, they're saying he didn't do this at all, right? So their argument is not he was trying to trick her. It was, I don't even know. Like you say, they haven't really articulated.
Well, yeah, I think it's
Cohen
sort of like
working on his own, you know.
At this point, I think it's a grab bag. If he did it, yeah, he did it to preserve Melania's feelings. Also, he didn't do it. But if he did do it, that's where we're going next.
But it's so interesting, it's, you know, because, yeah, I think you're right. But the Melania feeling part just like hasn't, it hasn't come into it at all yet, right? They're still protesting the, he doesn't have any fingerprints on this, you know, even though they haven't, really still haven't articulated the, like, okay, well, someone did it, right? So like, where is that coming from?
I don't remember with that, but I think the reason that Edwards, you know, got off is the reason that Edwards was acquitted is that most of the stuff happened after the election was over, right? So, and at least as far as I know, there was no thing where she was threatening to come forward or something like that. So his argument was much more plausible, both on the timing and the facts of the case. And I mean, that was, to put it mildly, kind of a messy case. I mean, his wife had cancer, you know, and so a pretty good reason you wouldn't want her finding out. Also a good reason not for having the affair while your wife is wrestling with what turned out to be, you know, she died of that cancer, although, you know, a few years later. Again, just the timing and everything was very different. But I would certainly, it will be interesting to see, A, if they present any coherent theory of the case. And if they do, I would certainly think a far better case would not be to make this absurd argument that Michael Cohen had gone rogue doing this, would be to say he was doing it over his embarrassment to his kids, embarrassment to Melania, embarrassment to everybody, because I would certainly think you could make an argument and you'd kind of have to go on the stand, but that's Trump's problem, that's going to be so difficult, to say, I was going to be exposed having an affair. I didn't do a calculus in my head what quanta of my embarrassment is not wanting the public to know because it might impact my election outcome versus what part of it is my embarrassment vis-a-vis my wife, who I see every day and I'm ashamed and all this kind of stuff. You're getting into this very textbook calculus where I was about to be exposed, something I had done that I was ashamed of. I wanted to make sure it didn't come out. I think that is whether it is plausible for Trump, I don't really think so. But at a human level, that's plausible. We don't always make this kind of how much is the campaign, how much is my personal embarrassment. That's not how people think, right? But to say like, yeah, Cohn, I don't know what he was doing. He was out there covering up my infidelities with my wife with no permission of mine. I was shocked when I found out about it. And what was he thinking covering up all my, extramarital affairs?
Which I didn't do. Right.
Yeah. Also, I didn't do
that. He's covering up a story that I never did to begin with.
He was making them up to cover them up.
Yeah.
He was falsely setting me up to have evidence of extramarital affairs, which he would then cover up with his own money.
It's so incoherent, but it's funny because listening to you present the much more kind of narratively stitched version where he does this to avoid, shame and avoid humiliating his wife, it's just like, it's so almost equally far-fetched because I just don't know that even if it was the best route to keep himself out of trouble, if he is like psychologically able to say, I was embarrassed,
I was wrong.
I made a mistake. Yeah. I don't know if his like psychic well-being could sustain something like that. And that kind of played into the opening arguments as well, where you had the prosecutor or the defense try to humanize him, right? Do the whole, he's a dad, he's a husband, just like me. And it's just, it reads so funny because you can't take someone like Trump whose entire time in the spotlight, pre-political career as well, has been premised on him being this like larger than life caricature stand-in figure for a rich real estate businessman in New York. Like his whole life has been kind of a walking joke. That's why he used to just kind of stride onto the set of like Home Alone 2 or whatever and stride off again because he's just part of the New York tapestry. But anything that is premised like this on him being this very like fallible human who just kind of panicked and didn't think of it beyond that. I mean, with the asterisks of even if they allowed any, admittance that he did do this, which they're still not there yet either. I mean, that just, it just sounds so like no chance that'll happen. Like that he would rather put up this kind of incomprehensible, smorgasbord of my underlings weren't doing what they should have been and I wasn't directing them and I had no idea what was going on because I was running a campaign. Like that seems like more attractive to him than what would be a more plausible narrative.
Yeah, I think the way I would put it is that the sudden embarrassment shame argument is a much more humanly plausible argument in this case than the truly absurd argument that my fixer was, without me knowing, covering up sex infractions, peccadillo, whatever you want to call them, without my knowing it, when I hadn't even done them.
Yeah, and which with were his fake own stories money. To begin with.
Yeah, which is so plausible. But as you say, it is a very tall order for him to make that believable because he's him. And the thing with Trump is that it is part of his brand that he is a player, right? Yeah, I'm married, but come on, right? You can't keep a lion like me in the cage, right? That guy, I mean, that is his thing. Even when he says like, hey, she's not my type, okay, got it? I play, but only with the top shelf women, that whole kind of thing. So the idea is totally implausible based on how he presents himself and how he is, at least to the level of like, of course he cheats constantly. That's how his relationships seem to originate occasionally, right? That's what McDougal thought, right? And on the one hand, it sort of sounds sad that she was, no, he strung her along thinking, hey, you're going to be my new wife, but like work for Marla Maples, right? You know, who knows, right? Lightning can strike twice. But the other thing, and I think you've hit it on the mark, the idea that he could say, I was ashamed. I had really done something terrible. I love my wife and I did this thing and I couldn't take it back, but I at least wanted to save her from the embarrassment and myself from the embarrassment. I'm just human. Is so off brand. I think he would he'd rather spend some time in jail. It would be like a psychic death for him to ever admit he did something wrong.
Totally. And it's funny because this line he has straddled, like the impression that he is, you know, he's a playboy, he's a cad, right? Has served him so well in his other political interests, right? Like abortion is such a good example of this, where everyone, I mean, we hear this from like focus groups and stuff. Everyone knows he doesn't really care about abortion, right? Like voters will voluntarily say they think he probably has paid for them before. But then he kind of, you know, with his other hand, will just do the bidding of the kind of right-wing religious nutcases, thereby allowing him to like kind of keep a coalition together of the people who are, you know, chanting rosaries outside of Planned Parenthood clinics. And then those who are like, whatever, you know, don't really care about this, but like the right of the party kind of dictates this one approach, and it lets him kind of straddle the line where he acts as the biggest force in anti-abortion politics than we've ever seen, but he doesn't have to cloak himself with like the Mike Pencean religious weirdness. Like he still gets to retain some level of normalcy, and that works for him in a whole bunch of ways, where he can kind of comfort the zealots, but also keep his distance from them, because nobody thinks that he actually is this like Christian nationalist weirdo. And this is like the one distinct case where this just impenetrable persona is kind of playing against his interests.
Yeah, where he kind of gets caught out by it, and he can't. And you know, there are some evangelicals and traditionalist Catholics who kind of buy into the sort of the absurd Trump myth that, you know, real man of God. But the more, you know, how to put it, you know, open-eyed among them will say kind of like, does he not believe it? Is he a cad? Like, okay. He got us our judges, though. So, like, who cares? Right. He got us our judges. And, you know, I think to their point of view, you know, Reagan, Bush, both Bushes, kind of like, you know, they put people on. They didn't really grill them to make sure they were kind of like totally down the line. Trump, you know, he made us a promise. And wow, did he deliver. Right. And even within the Christianity and to some extent within Judaism, there is an archetype that fits nicely. David was a player. He was a total player. He even like got one dude killed so he could have his wife. Right. I mean, David was a total player, but God used him for all the good stuff. So there's even like an archetype in Christianity that you don't even have to work it very hard. It's like, you know, I don't want to say David was a Trumpy figure. He's kind of a big, David is a kind of a major influencer in my people's tradition, but you know, kind of a little bit. Right. So, I am very curious how they, you know, I guess it is interesting to see, you know, kind of what will their argument be. I have to imagine if they're smart, their real argument is just, come on, this is just, you think Trump's bad and you're kind of putting all this stuff together to make it election interference. And like, you didn't declare your hush, you know, your sex hush money thing properly for taxes, that you kind of say something like, it's hush money. Of course, you're not going to, that's what hush money is. You know, it almost like I think they have to play for a version of jury nullification to just say, like, whatever theories you have, this just isn't right. This is politics. This is not a criminal thing. And that I think is their best. That's their best hope in reality.
Which is what they're going for. I mean, I think the problem with that theory is it rests on no facts, right? It's just kind of the framing of this whole thing as like a witch hunt. And then, but the pesky part of a trial is they're going to have to get into specific episodes and specific fact patterns. And there, that's when the kind of overarching narrative stuff has to be backed up by something. And that's where I think they might run into trouble. But one other thing on the Trump religious side is like my favorite anecdote is in this space is it was reported that he had a call with Mike Johnson and Johnson ended it with some kind of, you know, I'll be praying for you, Mr. President or something. And Trump said, tell God I say hi, which I think is legitimately really funny. And also just redounds to this thing that like, tell your friend God, you know, like,
no, there's Trump does have this, does have this clumsy literalism that comes out in various ways. Because, you know, in Trump's head, he's like, Mike Johnson thinks he talks to a wizard named God.
Exactly.
So Mike Johnson will feel good if I tell him to say hi to the wizard. Hi, wizard. Right? So it just shows you the total cynicism of Trump's internal idea system, but also the kind of these little small nuggets of something that kind of feels like sincerity within the swirl of cynicism. Like he will, I'm talking Mike Johnson's language. Say hi to the wizard.
Yeah.
Exactly. Give him my best, Mike, as a token of my respect to you, right, and your wizard. And I guess this goes to the point about, you know, kind of what jury nullification is, because certainly the judge is going to make clear, you're not here to decide whether New York state laws should say that you're not allowed to falsify business records. And it's not for you to decide whether an intent for a secondary bad act makes it a felony. Here's the law. Here's what you have to do to violate the law. And did he violate the law? And the great majority of jurors will take those instructions very seriously. And it comes down to the jury instructions, which obviously both sides lawyer very aggressively for obvious reasons, and the way that each side is able to make its case. If you're able to have that be very clear, here's what the law says, here's what needs to be proven for the law to have been broken, and are those fact things lining up? Jurors do not actually have to do that if they don't want to. There's this kind of complexities in the evolution of the jury system over the last 400 or 500 years. And that is why it is important. That is one of the valuable things about juries, because at the end of the day, it's not just about how questions constructed by lawyers get answered by a narrow arrangement of facts and factual questions you need to prove. At the end of the day, you have 12 people picked pretty much willy-nilly out of the population, and you have to convince them at some basic level not to think, hey, this is just bullshit, man. I'm not convicting on this. This is bullshit. That is one of the real values of the jury system. And originally that was, and we've kind of, in the way that the legal profession evolved over the last 150 years, we've kind of tried to diminish that. In any case, that I think is what Trump has to hope, that you're going to get someone who will basically disregard the judge's instructions and just say, you know what, I'm not buying it. I'm not going to ever convict on this. And we'll see. That could happen. That could happen. Juries are weird, but we'll see.
And then just the other thing we should talk about trial-wise before we move on is that today, before the jury got there. They also, the judge and the lawyers had some back and forth about whether or not Trump had violated his gag order. The prosecution said he'd done so, you know, upwards of 10 times. Right now, they're just asking for fines per violation, but kind of leaving the door open to imprisonment, you know, if he keeps down this road. And, you know, more than anything else, it was just an episode that shows like Trump's lawyers are getting themselves into trouble. Like they're really getting themselves on the bad side of this judge. And I know that that redounds to their central thesis that this is a sham proceeding, that the process is as against Trump as everything else, you know, that this is just a witch hunt, blah, blah, blah. But the problem with that is that most people don't like to piss off the judge because that can have some very real ramifications for you in all these, you know, small and large ways. You know, if you have a judge on your side, that's just a better place to be for your client's case. And so this morning was just a good microcosm of that because prosecution lays out their case, right? They're like, he keeps doing this. He keeps going on Truth Social. He keeps reposting things. You know, he leaves this courtroom and he goes right up to a camera bank and kind of decries the whole thing being rigged against him. You know, he's going after family members, which is a pretty pointed reference to Trump's little dalliance with like going after the judge's daughter. And so they lay out their argument, you know, by Josh's account, the judge pretty much kind of just sits there and listens and is like, all right, thank you. Defense, what do you have to say? And that just devolved into like a spat between the judge and Todd Blanche. Because, you know, Blanche is saying, well, he's responding to things, you know, you have to let him talk. And the judge is like, okay, what is he responding to? And then they'll be like, well, the whole impression of blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the judge got mad and Todd says, you know, he's just responding to the fact that there are two different kind of systems of justice. And the judge is like, you think there are two different systems of justice in my courtroom right now, you know, and at one point the judge said, you're losing all credibility with this court, which I know that we're all, we all sometimes operate under, I think, this kind of delusion that no rules apply to Trump, everything slips off him. But you do not want to hear on the second substantive day of the trial that you have so pissed off the judge that he thinks you lack credibility and are a fundamentally unserious actor, while the guys on the other side who are trying to put your client in jail are being, you know, normal, respectful, kind of rule following, easy to work with actors. That's just, you know, from my legal prowess to yours, not where you want to be during a criminal trial. More of this scintillating content after these messages.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Back to the show.
Yeah, there's... I didn't read the article, but when I was going through my email today, I think it's a piece in New York Magazine, was basically talking about Todd Blanche and saying that, you know, unlike a lot of other Trump lawyers, he has gone into this trial with the idea, I'm going to be Trump's lawyer without being a Trump lawyer, right? I am going to get him acquitted, but I'm going to do it without going down the sort of the train to nonsenseville that kind of happens to all. I mean, some of them start that way, like Alina Habba, they start that way, but others kind of start off as somewhat respected lawyers, right? And then, and so anyway, I didn't read the article, but I think it framed it interestingly that he thinks he's going to be able to do this without being kind of corrupted by Trump, without being kind of pulled into the Trumpian vortex. And it at least seems here that he's kind of getting sucked in, right? And, you know, it's one of these things where it's a, the gag order concept is a fairly straightforward thing, that there's some things you, during a trial, you may not be able to talk about. Your feeling upset about it or wanting to talk about it is not an affirmative, you know, that doesn't change that. And you're, the judge may decide you are not allowed to threaten some people, or you may have threatened them enough times that you're not even allowed to talk about them. So this all kind of, well, what about the narrative of two, like, dude, really? Like, what are you talking about? So I guess we'll see whether whether he is able to succeed at that, what seems to be his, you know, self-appointed mission.
And whether the judge will, you know, Trump keeps calling the bluff, actually put him behind bars. You know, it's hard to imagine. But with Trump, I mean, we've been doing this for like a week, and he's already like gone after his daughter and the and potential witnesses.
I do think, and this is many people have discussed this, that he is trying to, and he's getting pretty close to making a mockery of the judge. Like, you know, you're trying to control your court. I have publicly attacked and, you know, goaded people after you against your daughter, and I'm still doing it. I'm, you know, kind of like, it's the classic, you know, dominance politics. I'm going to like slap you and you're going to take it. And I'm going to slap you again and you're going to take it. So I don't know where this is going to go. I've seen a lot of people say, look, at the end of the day, it's a former president and possible future president. You're just not going to put him in jail for the night. You're just not. You're not even going to put him in that little holding cell that, you know, judges have their own little, like a little private mini jail in the back of the courtroom, right? You're not even going to do that. But I don't see how he is going to get through this without doing that and not being a mockery. And, you know, I have heard either from Trump people or people who are saying they know what's being talked about in Trump world, where they say, oh, well, that's just going to redound to Trump's benefit, you know, because that'll just make him a martyr. I don't buy that for a second. I don't buy that for a second in the sense of that that's actually going to help him, because I think what we have seen is that him being behind the defendant's table is not helping him. It makes him look dominated and like a criminal. It just does, right? And so I don't think that is going to be the impression. And I don't think Trump's up for it. I don't think he's like, yeah, put me in jail. It's going to help me. I think the idea of even being told to stay in that room for like 6 hours is like totally terrifying to him. So I think that is all bluster and bluff. That's my take.
I agree. And I think it's all just still tied into this fundamental dynamic where we're like under the spell of thinking that, you know, Trump upended expectations in 2016, thereby nothing that you used to be able to depend on, no conventional wisdom holds with him. And that, you know, that seeped into the trial coverage for a long time, kind of before it really happened. I mean, you had people all across the spectrum saying this helps Trump, this helps him paint things as a witch hunt, like you just got Trump elected. And, you know, I think we on the show have always been like, where is any kind of evidence or proof of that? Despite, you know, it is just this thing where some people are like, take what I normally think would happen to a presidential candidate and turn it on its head, and that's what's correct, even though, you know, 2016 is the outlier in this kind of data plot that we have. It's not the rule that has proven everything since.
Yeah, no, I think that is, I know we need to get on to the next issue, but it is, I think that's really the key, is that there is a, because some of this is like, he's going to stub his toe and then his toe is going to be all bloody and it's going to hurt. But actually, that is exactly what he wants to happen. And when you say that, it has this, the inversion has a, spurs a momentary feeling of awe and surprise that makes you think, that's so crazy, it might just be true. But in fact, it just doesn't make any sense at all. And that's kind of, you know, trust your instincts, not your momentary shock and awe.
Right. Okay, so we're going to briefly talk about Ukraine aid passing through the House, something that seemed like an impossibility not very long ago. And then that all changed very quickly, kind of on the momentum of the Iran attack against Israel. That sort of seemed to rev up the momentum again for giving Israel aid. And then Democrats were not going to let Israel aid move without Ukraine, knowing that if they did that, you know, that that's the end of the game for Ukraine. Yeah. So that all came together pretty quickly. You know, we had some kind of flare-ups of various other Republicans, you know, Thomas Massie, Paul Gosar saying, you know, we're actually going to back the motion to vacate as well. We're going to oust Mike Johnson for this, but that never came to fruition. The aid passed. It's kind of on a glide path now. The Senate is planning to vote on it as early as this afternoon, Tuesday afternoon. So it all happened pretty quickly. And on the one hand, you're just in this posture of like, okay, thank God, right? I mean, it wasn't that long ago that everyone who cared about Ukraine was in a state of despair, you know, just left to wonder if there's anything else the Biden administration can do to basically find some coins in the couch cushions, right, and send over. But now, I mean, they're getting a significant package. It's going to make a huge difference for the Ukrainians who are on the front lines. And we're just left with these questions, you know, one of which is what actually changed Mike Johnson around on this topic? And there have been some stories to kind of fill that void, but I have found them all a little lacking and a little too transparently self-serving. Like, you've got the line of, well, you know, Biden worked him hard and changed his mind. And it's like, that's nice, but we no longer live in political times where like the president of the opposite party can change your mind on some big piece of legislation. Like, that's just not, if that's ever how things worked, that's just not how they've worked now. And it's not like, you know, Biden would have kind of come to Johnson with arguments he's never heard before. And he's like, you know what? That's a great freaking point. Like, I didn't think about that. You've got the kind of related strain of this, which is, well, Mike Johnson saw some intelligence and that really shook him out of his stupor, which again, obviously, we don't know what the intelligence showed, but we can guess. It's not that hard to imagine. And that kind of goes into the more self-serving Mike Johnson piece of it, which is he recognized the hugeness of the moment and decided to put his job on the line, which again, he's been dragging this out for months and the conditions haven't meaningfully changed. I just don't fully buy it. Like, to me, I think what makes the most sense is maybe his recognition that his speakership has an expiration date on it. And is it worth buying himself a few more months to kind of go down in this particular kind of ignominy? So, you know, all that stuff. And then there's also the other kind of ongoing piece of this is the Marjorie Taylor Greene story, which is, you know, she for ages was saying, I'm in a motion to vacate if he helps Ukraine. He's helped Ukraine. Everyone's like, all right, so where's the motion to vacate? You know, you've been saying you're going to do this for a while. And she's been going on this little media tour of being like, he has betrayed us. He's making Republicans look like fools. He's tanking Trump's reelection prospects. But she's not acting on them. You know, she's a woman on an island. You know, Trump has now been asked twice about this situation. And he's saying, you know, his most recent thing was, I think he's doing a good job. You know, he's only got a one vote majority. He can't do exactly what he wants. So even he is kind of abandoning Marjorie. And her newest posture is basically, I'm going to let everyone go home and get a real earful from their constituents who are furious about this. And then we'll come back and boot Mike Johnson, which is like, ludicrous from a lot of different perspectives, but also just the basic Washington fact of letting people go home and talk to constituents almost never intensifies pressure, with the exception of like really big kind of everyone knows about it stories, such as trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act or confirming Brett Kavanaugh or something with that kind of salience. But I mean, Ukraine aid, I just don't think fits into that bucket. I don't think you're going to have people in like the second district of Alabama like worked up about it or whatever. So this idea that they're going to go home and get on all this pressure and then come back and then act when the heat of the moment has long passed, I mean, that's just pretty ludicrous. That's pretty clearly just face saving for she doesn't want to do this for, you know, whatever reason. Maybe doesn't want to throw the House into more turmoil right before the election, maybe realizes that there's no one else who could be the Speaker. So if she does that, I mean, Republicans will kind of single-handedly impair all of Congress's workability for the next few months, something that actually could, you know, permeate to normal people in a way that their dysfunction up till now has not.
I think that is really right. People are not, as much as we and most people who follow politics were totally transfixed last October when that whole like month-long process played out. It's not anything like the number of people paying attention during the, you know, the kind of the meat of a national election. I think what it really is, she's got her bluff called. That is really, I think, the long and the short of it. And as you said, she was all over social media over the weekend. Betrayal, you are done, you're done forever, you're this, you're that. And like every time she, you know, raised the volume to 9, to 10, even up to 11, it just brought out kind of like, you could do this right now. You know, you can break the glass, you can pull the alarm, and then you're going to have a vote. And you even seem to have enough votes to do it because the majority is so low. Even you three people, I think even those three could do it on their own. And so her bluff has been called, and she just, so I also think that that plays into it. I do think this kind of, this let's be legends vibe is probably maybe the glue that brings together a lot of these individually not satisfying explanations. Because yeah, we're not in the day where kind of like Joe Biden becomes kind of like BFFs and suddenly he can't say no to Joe. Because I think we all know that he may have supported Ukraine aid from the beginning, but it doesn't matter because the structure of the Republican House, you just can't do it. So convincing him isn't a satisfying explanation because it's not even clear he needs to be convinced. But if you start saying like, okay, we get it, kind of like, you know, Democrats love Ukraine, so you hate Ukraine and blah, you know, okay. But like, look, this could actually fall apart. And over the next couple months, you could have the lines break and suddenly they're at Kyiv, and that will be on you. This could really happen. And you have the Israel thing coming up where after that Iranian, that missile fusillade, that he kind of knows Israel aid has to happen. Like from his people, from Republicans, it has to happen. He knows it can't happen without bringing the Democrats along. That means you got to bring the Ukraine thing along. All, you know, all of these things kind of fit together. And he kind of at that point says a kind of like, look, there's a good chance we're going to lose the House in a few months anyway. There's a really good chance I'm not going to get elected again. So do I want to just sort of, you know, do a dignity bleed out for the next 6 months? Or am I just going to kind of roll the dice and say, fuck it? And like, this is actually the right thing to do. Together, I think those things kind of fit. And one thing, someone else made this point to me, and it has not been discussed, but I think it is actually possibly a pretty key thing here. Trump is distracted. Trump is distracted. He is 100% focused on that trial. And I think what we've seen is, like, remember the immigration bill? That was moving along. They've got a gang over in the Senate, blah, 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 blah. And at a certain point, Trump said, you know, no. And at that point, it totally fell apart. And so I'm not sure it is the explanation, but it may be a key reason why, unlike a lot of other things, this didn't blow up at the last second. Because I think Trump feels like he has his hands full and he's not focused on it. And unlike the immigration thing, Trump knows he needs the immigration issue to win the election. The Ukraine issue, like what? Like no one really, there's a lot of different things going on about Ukraine, but tossing them some more money is not going to affect his, even when Marjorie Greene said, oh, you've lost the election for Trump. If they had passed that immigration bill, I don't think it would have lost the election for Trump, but there's at least a set of moving parts where you can say, okay, you may have really undermined his key issue, and maybe that, you know, maybe that would. So yeah, I you know, it's that's still kind of the best I can think of as the explanation. But even, you know, maybe we'll have to wait for the memoir edition of Mike's podcast after he gets bounced from the house, right? And he can tell us what the real story is. But I do think that kind of a bit of let's be legends, let's kind of, can I be the cool kid in Washington? Because man, right now, editorial boards, I haven't seen, but I'm sure like the Times and the Post are writing like, we're not supporters of Mike Johnson, but man, Mike Johnson, you know, kind of take your hats off to this man. He stood tall. He's a little mini Churchill, all that kind of stuff. Everybody likes that. They might say they don't like it, but they like it.
Totally. And I think the point about the Trump distraction with the immigration bill is a really good one, also because Ukraine just doesn't have the same salience, right? I mean, the Republicans who are like anti-Ukraine, I mean, it's a significant contingent and that has its own, you know, set of concerns and everything, but it's not like this is what kind of Republican voters care about. It's not the A block on Fox News. Like, this is the worrying kind of contagion of pro-Russian propaganda through the Republican Party. But I mean, it split the House, right? I mean, we're going to definitely see a bunch of Republican senators vote for it. I mean, McConnell's going to vote for it. It's not the same kind of hyper-partisan issue as immigration. So I do think that Johnson some leeway to be like the good guy, but not on the make or break topic for the party.
No, I think that's right. And you know, you have that issue. There certainly are people in the House that they want America to be on team authoritarian worldwide. And that means not just no aid, not giving taxpayer dollars and blah, blah, blah. We want Ukraine to lose. But for a big chunk of the Republicans, it's Ukraine Democrat, anti-Ukraine Republican. It's that kind of stuff. Like, you want it, so I don't want it kind of thing. Mm-hmm. As you say, that's not the same as immigration. Immigration is their kind of full court issue.
Right. Okay, so we're going to end with a little Supreme Court corner because there's a lot going on there this week. Yesterday, there were arguments on this. Oregon City has a ban against sleeping outside with any bedding, even a blanket. And this class of quote involuntary homeless people brought the case saying that that's an infringement on their Eighth Amendment right because it is just criminalizing them for being homeless, not for kind of doing downstream acts of being homeless, which are illegal, you know, going to the bathroom in public or setting a fire in a park to keep warm, but just sleeping outside with a blanket, they're arguing that is just being homeless. That is, and there was an old case under the Eighth Amendment that said you couldn't criminalize someone just for being a drug addict. You know, you can't like take someone has like track marks or evidence that they are addicted to drugs and just put them in jail for that alone without the downstream effect. So, you know, it's kind of a creative argument. It's kind of interesting that it was brought by a class of, you know, people who are homeless. It also is the kind of thing that it almost doesn't matter what the legal arguments are because it's so far-fetched to imagine this court expanding constitutional protections for homeless people. That's just so far out of what they care about. And that's kind of my impression after watching the oral arguments was I think we're probably in for a 6-3 upholding the essential ban on being homeless. But, you know, it's a kind of case that is not really fully in our wheelhouse of things that we usually cover, but it's such an interesting argument and it's so topical in the way of how cities kind of deal with their homeless populations, which right now mostly amounts to clearing encampments every once in a while and kind of sending a bunch of people to jail and then they get out of jail and they set up encampments again and it's this never-ending circle where no one is helped or served but just kind of pushing these people from one place to another because we as a society, you know, consider it to be unsightly and a blight and something you don't want around and you never. And it's rare to find a city that's kind of dealing with the problem with any degree of like empathy beyond that. So interesting case. Would be shocked if we don't just get some kind of full 6'3". You know, the most interesting thing and the most tea leaf reading part of it to me was that John Roberts was really leading the right wing charge against in favor of upholding this ban. You know, he did a lot of, because the whole thing is like, is it, you can't be punished for your quote unquote status of being a homeless person. So he's saying, you know, what about the status of being a bank robber, which is like downright Samuel Alito of him. So, you know, that doesn't look good, but that was yesterday. And then we have two more big ones coming up this week, which are tomorrow, Wednesday. There'll be a case about whether this federal law that dictates that hospitals that use Medicare funding, that they have to stabilize patients who come into emergency rooms. This was basically passed because hospitals were like dumping sick, uninsured people into other hospitals or refusing to treat them because it was expensive. So you have to stabilize someone who comes in a state of emergency. And the government saying that narrow window, that supersedes abortion bans that don't allow for this kind of emergency care. And this is coming out of Idaho, where their abortion ban only allows for medical interference to prevent death. And the government is saying, well, the federal statute is a little broader than that. Like, it is also to prevent, you know, serious illness or injury or harm. So in that narrow instance, supremacy clause kicks in and the federal statute governs. But, you know, we already have some tea leaves that one is not going to go well for the federal government, because the Supreme Court interceded early. They allowed Idaho to kind of reimpose the ban while this was working its way through the courts. So that's on deck for tomorrow, Wednesday. And then Thursday are the big Trump immunity arguments, which you might have forgotten about and would totally be permitted to do so, because it was back in December when Jack Smith asked the Supreme Court to intercede and answer this question now rather than wasting all this time. And here we are almost in May when they're going to hear the case finally. And, you know, just a refresher, because it's been a while since we've talked about this, but this is an offshoot of the January 6th case, where Trump is trying to basically wash away the whole case with this little two-pronged argument. One, that everything he did around January 6th were part of his official duties as president, and therefore he is immune from prosecution. And then two, that he was impeached and he was acquitted. So this is something akin to some, like, you know, jerry-rigged double jeopardy.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's where we are. But the Supreme Court only took up the first question. So did his acts on January 6th constitute official acts as president? And that's what they're going to hear on Thursday. And, you know, the common wisdom from almost everyone on this case are that Trump's arguments are so weak and greenlighting them would so upend the Constitution, which was so specifically written to prevent, you know, the leader of the states from becoming the kind of monarch that they had just overthrown, that even this court is not going to greenlight the doily-like argument that he's putting before them. But, you know, the other piece of this is, to some degree, they've already ruled in Trump's favor by pushing off the trial for effectively 4 months, you know, almost 5 months, making it very unlikely that this is going to, or at least putting it in doubt if this trial will even meaningfully start again before the election, much less, I mean, there's almost no chance it would wrap up. But we still have to go all the way back down to the district court to get started on the merits after they kind of hear arguments and then render their decision. And they've let all this time, you know, weeks elapse between each step of this, which is a little befuddling. And, you know, we've talked about this on the pod before, but a lot of people were kind of shocked when they said they were going to take up this issue, because they were thinking, well, maybe the internal concession was, we won't intercede when Jack Smith wants us to, but we're going to let the DC circuit decide, and then we will refuse to take it up then. So their decision will kind of rule the day, and it'll go back to the district court, and that's a compromise. But, you know, they have dragged it out at every point possible.
Yeah. I mean, we're long past the point where the Supreme Court is clearly, they are clearly doing everything they can within the realm of colorable plausibility to delay this trial. It's been suggested to me since I wrote a piece several days ago, basically saying that, you know, the trial is probably going to start just before the election, something like that. There's one possibility, which I had seen as not a huge possibility. Other people are seeing as a very good open shot for them to basically, they will come up with some very thin kind of immunity and then say, all right, here's the prongs that apply. You send that back to the trial court, leave it up to Judge Chutkan to sort of apply those prongs to the facts. Then Trump says, oh, no. She's not applying them correctly. Kick it back to the Supreme Court and you get a whole new round, in which case, you know, you're to May of 2025. Who knows? Who knows? Maybe that's possible. It's beyond my ability to have any sense of whether that makes sense or not. But I do, my governing sense of this whole question is that the current Supreme Court will do everything it can to help Trump, to help Republicans within the realm of things that are considered basically reasonable jurisprudence and things that are within the broad guardrails of the appellate process. So when they said, hey, we're not going to jump over the appellate, circuit court, you got to go through them first. That's just the normal process. So you can't say that's outrageous because that's literally the normal process. And now when the court decides to take up something that, consequential case that the circuit court came to a decision on, well, that's what Supreme Courts do, right? But you are at the edge now of like, it's not even plausible for people who are on your side. You're just delaying it. And I generally think they will not do things that really damage the court's credibility because they don't care enough about Trump to really make themselves look stupid on his behalf. But we're right at the edge here now with this case because it's pretty transparent. But who knows? Who knows what will, happen? But just so you didn't mention it, but you will be covering these all, or at least the immunity thing, you'll be covering them. I'm not sure we'll be covering them all with a live blog, but this is basically the rest of the week for you of covering this group of cases for our readers and listeners.
Yep. The plan is to live blog both the abortion case and the immunity case. So come on down to the website if you want to follow along with me.
Yeah. Well, live blogs are hot at the moment. We're doing them right and left. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Well, I think that is it for our episode today. We had a lot to cover. And as usual, we'll see you next week. And we'll be back to our normal Wednesday schedule. And just to remind you, in case various news breaks, we recorded this episode on Tuesday. So anything that happened on the rest of Tuesday through Wednesday, we will not have known about yet. And as I said, back to Wednesday next week. And I think that's it, right?
All right. See you then.
All right, later.
The Josh Marshall Podcast is hosted by me, TPM reporter Kate Riga, and TPM founder, editor-in-chief Josh Marshall. The show is produced by Jackie Wilhelm. Thanks to Why Not Jansfeld for our podcast theme song, and thanks to all our TPM members who make this possible. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and subscribe wherever you listen.